Two guests for you tonight on Coast to Coast. First, Tom Carey. He's been a Mutual UFO Network State Section Director in the southeastern Pennsylvania area, special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. Tom began investigating aspects of the Roswell incident back in 91 for the Roswell investigation team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt. And since 1998, has teamed exclusively with Don Schmidt to continue investigations. Here's Tom Carey. Hey, Tom, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Thanks, George. Good to be with you.
I'm looking forward to this one tonight, Tom.
Thank you.
Don Schmidt, former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, where he served as director of special investigations for 10 years. Prior to that, he was a special investigator for the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek for the International UFO Reporter. Here's Don Schmidt. Hey, Don, how are you?
Good evening, George. Tom and I are here to report from the front line this evening.
Excellent. Good to have you guys up at the front line, because I know we'll get information with you two out there.
We're ready.
How did you two get together and team up, first of all? Go ahead, Don. You first.
Well, as you had mentioned, Kevin Randall and I had actually started an independent investigation of Roswell in the beginning of 1989, and it was after I had sat down with Stanton Friedman and asked him if he felt they had talked to all the principal witnesses. And much to my surprise, and as it turned out, much to my delight, Stan acknowledged that he was very sure there were still dozens, possibly hundreds of people that were still very much with us at that time. And we were very skeptical on the case. In fact, our first trip to New Mexico, that February of 89, we thought we'd wrap this up in a single weekend.
Now, did you think something unusual crashed, or were you taking the government's posture at the time?
Not so much the government's balloon explanation, but we had not even read the previous released book, Roswell Incident, from 1980. I just couldn't accept that the government could keep something of this magnitude a secret for that many years. And we quickly, you know, especially after talking to firsthand witnesses who actually held the material in their hands, and it clearly defied anything of a conventional nature. And then just accepting the fact that it was not being kept secret. People were talking about this as evidence with Major Jesse Marcel, who went public in 1978. The problem has always been that the government's ridicule factor is still very extant. That it's been, people have been trying to leak this out for these past 60-some years, but sadly, we haven't been listening.
That's so true. Tom Carey, let's review a little bit the Roswell incident. Lots of people are familiar with it, but there are a few people who probably don't. It happened 62 years ago. Tell us about it.
Yes, George, the Roswell incident is the only case that I know of where the Air Force actually admitted that UFOs were real. And by UFOs, I mean a craft from another planet other than the Earth. It was the only time that they ever admitted that it was real. And they did that back in July of 1947, when a craft of unknown origin crashed north of the town of Roswell. They put out a newspaper headline the next day and said that the RAAF, the Roswell Army Airfield, just south of Roswell, had recovered a flying saucer. Within hours, however, they withdrew that pronouncement and said that they did not recover a flying saucer. It was a weather balloon, a common weather balloon. The story died at that point for 30 years until 1978, when the former base intelligence officer, Jesse Marcel Sr., came forward and went public and said that he had held pieces of an extraterrestrial craft in his hand. I think he said the craft came to Earth, but it was not of the Earth. So that began the civilian investigation of the case, which continues today.
And still perplexes so many people, Tom.
Yes. It's perplexing in that we have this welter of evidence. Don and I and other investigators before us, we have accumulated over 600 witnesses to an extraterrestrial crash. Yet the Air Force maintains that it was nothing more than, well, first a common weather balloon, but now this high-altitude balloon, Project Mogul. But when you examine Project Mogul, it falls apart like a cheap suit.
Now, Don Schmidt, there was another crash site, too, involved here, right?
Well, we have a debris field, which is about 70 miles northwest of the town of Roswell. And then along that trajectory line, we have the site much closer to the town of Roswell itself, about 40 miles to the north. That in itself would rule out a weather balloon, the fact that you have multiple sites. And we've been to these two particular areas, and in fact, we've had three archaeological digs at the debris field site, which is the site that Major Marcel first arrived at. Once the rancher, Mac Brazel, the discoverer of that site, led him and a counterintelligence officer by the name of Captain Sheridan Cavett. So the hope is that we still may find some remnants, some artifacts from the crash, but there's no question that they have scoured, they have cleaned that site very thoroughly. As evidence, as we describe even in the recent revision in the new book that is just coming out, that they were still going out 2.5 to 3 years after the incident, still searching for pieces of that wreckage.
They combed it pretty well, though, didn't they, Don?
Industrial vacuum cleaners we've had described to us that as one of the soldiers described, he said, if it didn't move, pick it up.
Tom Carey, tell me a little bit about the sci-fi-sponsored archaeological dig.
Well, and there were two of them. One major dig in 2002 and one less so in 2006 for their sci-fi investigate show. But in 2002, we approached the Sci-Fi Channel and to see if they were interested in doing something on the Roswell incident. And we hooked up with an executive producer there, Larry Landsman, mm-hmm. and he asked us, well, what, in our opinion, would move the case forward? And we both agreed that an archaeological dig at the debris field site that Don had described would be the best thing that we could think of that would move the case forward. We had always wanted to go back to that site and conduct a full-scale dig subsequent to the 1989 QFOS preliminary dig that had taken place. So the Sci-Fi Channel funded it. We got volunteers. We approached the University of New Mexico's Office of Contract Archaeology in Albuquerque, and to our surprise, they were all for the dig.
Good.
They were eager to do it. There was no laughing matter. It was to them, the Roswell incident had become part of New Mexico lore, and here was a chance to perhaps prove it, yay or nay, once and for all. So we got together. We put the University of New Mexico and the Sci-Fi Channel and the archaeologists, and we went at it.
How close do you think you got to the crash site? You think you were right there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We don't need GPS coordinates. There were some hubbub by others about did we have the right coordinates. Well, we don't need coordinates to get to the site. We've been there so many times, and I believe it was Don can correct me on this. It was Mac Brazel's son that first took us there.
That's correct.
When I went to Hawaii a few years ago and flew over Pearl Harbor, I couldn't realize two things. It just was inspiring to me, one, just to be able to be there, but it just seems so small, and you know, looking down on it, to think of how World War II began for us and our involvement in everything. And then what I tried to picture, and this was a few years ago, but I was trying to picture something that happened 60-plus years ago. And it was just, it was weird. It really was. Did you both feel that out there on the crash site?
Oh, no question of that. The first time we actually made it to the very site, as Tom described, with the aid of Mac Brazel's very son, Bill Jr., who had been there days after the military cleanup. So he could take us to that very site and describe what he saw, all the tire tracks, the gouge that extended from the upper pinnacle to the northwest, moving to the southeast. But it was like being present on a battlefield. You just couldn't help but feel that something tragic had happened, such as a crash,
right,
with fatalities. And then beyond that, there was almost a gleefulness that we had actually made it to the very, to the precise location. And we ran. We ran from one end to the other because we were, again, we felt as though we were not only at a historic site, but that we were at an unprecedented location, something that hasn't happened in the history of mankind.
Was there, does there remain some kind of holy grail of the Roswell case or something bizarre and strange still?
Well, our holy grail is the search for physical evidence. And by holy grail, we are reserving that term for the so-called memory medal. The witnesses all describe, the witnesses who held the medal in their hands, who picked it up, who put it in burlap bags, who, for whatever opportunity they had to actually hold this material, describe this certain type of wreckage as being light as a feather, ultra strong, but that you could still scrunch it up in your hand to where it felt like you didn't have anything in your hand at all, and then lay it out over a flat surface, and it would just flow out like water and resume
right back. Yeah,
its original shape. That's what we call the Holy Grail of Roswell. We are actively searching for a piece of that because you really, just by looking at it and holding it, you know that you have something extraordinary there. You wouldn't have to send it out to a lab and have it get lost for you to realize that this is something truly extraordinary.
What about the markings, too, the inscriptions that apparently might have been on a piece of metal?
Such as described by Jesse Marcel Jr.
Yes.
And a number of others associated with the case. In fact, a number of the military personnel, such as Robert Shirky, who was in the operations building, as some of the material was transited through before it was first flown out, in a number of boxes, observed some of that symbology. It's always been described as Egyptian-like or even hieroglyphic-like, but they're basically just geometric patterns that were actually embossed into the metal, the same type of metal, slightly flexible, but yet you couldn't break it, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't burn it, and yet it had these symbols as some of the people, such as even the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, even mentioned to his wife, Ethel, at that time, that it had strange writing on some of the wreckage. And it looked Russian, but then they quickly realized it wasn't Russian, that it was something beyond their comprehension.
The situation with Roswell, assuming it occurred the way you've reported on it, and Tom, you've done it, and Stanton and Kevin, why the cover-up, in your opinions?
Well, the cover-up had very logical reasons originally, back in 1947. They didn't know what they had. If you want to keep it from your enemies, you also have to keep it from your friends. So when you don't know what you have, the military mindset is that you cover it up. Also, Cold War was just beginning in 1947. The Iron Curtain had dropped, I forget what Winston Churchill's words were, between Stettin in the north and something in the south. Anyway, Cold War was beginning, and our adversary was a new world power, the Soviet Union. So we wanted to certainly keep whatever we had from them. And also, George, the 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast was still fresh in people's minds that panicked the entire East Coast of the United States with a radio show starring Orson Welles. I think it was the Mercury Star Theater, even announcing up front that it was just a radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. It still panicked the entire East Coast. So given those sets of circumstances in 1947, the fact that the Roswell incident was covered up was probably not a bad decision to make.
What do you two think of the late Walter Hout's affidavit, which I think is incredible?
Yes, no doubt. And we were very instrumental in assisting Walter in preparing that posthumous statement, because it was something he had always resisted. As many people who had the good fortune of meeting Walter throughout the years, especially in his position of the founder of the museum in Roswell, he would only admit that he put out the press release. He took the order from his acting officer, Colonel Blanchard, to type it up and hand deliver it to the two radio stations and the two newspapers in town, and that was the extent of it. But year after year, we kept going back because we couldn't believe that, as Walter described it, he and Colonel Blanchard were like a nephew and an uncle. They were that close. In fact, when Blanchard, who would die in Washington right at the Pentagon, a four-star general, so much for his being reprimanded for overreacting and putting out this press release, they would send a special courier to Roswell to announce his passing to Walter Hout.
Yeah.
That's how close. And we just couldn't believe that they shared such a bond, and yet he was prevented from knowing the full story of what had happened back in 1947. And Walter would slowly and very methodically start describing things, and he would let, you know, us in on some of these facts and details. And that became his final statement. And within the last few weeks, it's something that's not even in the present book, but we found that Walter, even in his own handwriting, acknowledged who the ambulance driver was who brought three of the bodies in through the south gate. And in his own handwriting, he identifies that individual as Private First Class Irwin Fortman, who was with the medical squad, in the yearbook, so we can document his presence. And in his handwriting, he writes, "Drove ambulance, south gate, three bodies and wreckage, body bags, two hangar." Mentions that his father was a master sergeant.
You don't put dummies in body bags, do you?
Well, that's precisely the point. But there it is once again in Walter's handwriting as we continue to go through his personal effects. And let's have the handwriting analysts, you know, argue as to whether it's authentic or not. But I'll state to your audience right here and now, it is in Walter's handwriting. And there again, it's another piece of the puzzle that is clearly suggests that this was something well beyond a weather balloon.
We're talking with Tom Carey, Don Schmidt. Their latest work is their revised book of Witness to Roswell. When we come right back, we'll talk about their best-selling book, which they wrote in 2007 and 8, why they did that and what they uncovered as we get into why they decided to revise this book. As a matter of fact, Edgar Mitchell wrote the foreword to it. And Don and Tom asked me if I would write the afterword, which I so graciously volunteered to do as well. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, tell me, why did you decide to write the book the first time, Witness to Roswell? Go ahead, Don.
That's easy, George. What happened was that, if you remember, 1997 was the 50th anniversary year of the Roswell incident.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Roswell books were written that year. There were a few before and almost none afterwards. Don and I wanted to continue a proactive Roswell investigation, so we teamed up in 1998. So by 2007, that's 9 years worth of work that we had accumulated for the 60th anniversary year in 2007. So we wanted to let everybody know that there was somebody still investigating the Roswell case, and here's what we've been finding. So that's why we wrote the book, to let people know that we were on the case, and we believe that we moved the case forward, you know, during the time that we had been a team. So that's why we wrote the first book. And I have to say, we were overwhelmed at the response. We received emails and correspondence from all over the world thanking us for writing the book. And the consensus was that it was the finest book on Roswell ever written.
Tom, was it difficult to find some of the people?
Absolutely. George, they're not standing up waving a flag saying, come and interview me. That is not what's happening. We have to first locate them. It usually starts out with a name, and then we try to locate the name, hope they're still alive, and hope that they will talk to us. Most people that were involved in this are gone now. I'd say at least 90% are gone, and of the remaining 10%, half of those are suffering from the ravages of old age and are not available to be interviewed. So that's what we're facing. Increasingly, we are interviewing family members, children and grandchildren. And perhaps when the principal would have been reluctant to talk, the surviving family members sometimes are not reluctant to talk. So that's the scenario that we are playing out.
I met a few years ago Glenn Dennis, the mortician. I'm pretty sure. Is he still alive?
Yes, he is still alive. He no longer does interviews. His wife is in failing health, and Glenn himself is...
He was pretty frail when I saw him.
Yes, and if you can imagine, even more so now. So... there's nothing more that we seek to gain as far as any testimony or corroboration, as Tom just described. And Stanton uses the same term that we're racing with the Undertaker, sadly. But then, hence, it's one of the reasons that we're all the more driven. Tom could describe how just within the last couple of days we've been exchanging, you know, half a dozen names again. Of people that we need to find, or new leads, new contact information. It's something that even in the process of when you finally sit down and decide you're going to write, you still have to have a cutoff point. And yet, even through that process, the investigation is still very active on our part because, again, we're running out of time.
Yes, we are. I mean, they'll all be gone soon. But you have them on record, and that's important.
And we provide them with that opportunity. And I think that's the principal reason for even the title of the first book and even the revision, that we allow the witnesses to finally go on the record, speak for themselves, tell the world what actually happened. And contrary to even what the government, now being up to their fourth explanation, that they stand up in defiance and say, well, I only have a period of days, weeks, months left. They can't hurt me any longer. This is the truth.
The picture of General Roger Ramey with Colonel Thomas DuBose.
Yes.
That looks like it was fabricated for the picture. I don't think that's the material, because that looks like weather balloon material. I think they just scattered that out there, didn't they?
Of course it was. In fact, even when... Colonel DuBose, who had retired Brigadier General, when Stanton and I went down to Orlando, Florida, and interviewed him, and he even signed a sworn affidavit describing how the balloon part of it, as he said, was a hoax. He went on to describe that they were the ones who switched the real material for the balloon. And he didn't even know where the balloon came from because they weren't launching them in Fort Worth, Texas, at Carswell Army Airfield, where he was headquartered with General Ramey at that time. You can see that in the pictures, you can see the wooden struts from the kite and the rotted neoprene rubber. Even the photographer, the late James Bond Johnson, said that you could smell the rotting rubber as he even approached the general's office. It sure doesn't look like anything the witnesses have described as being almost nigh indestructible. And the other thing that's very obvious is the fact that the foil looks very fresh. It looks very shiny and as though it was just put together. It doesn't appear to be something that was scattered out in the hot desert for days and then finally gathered up and sent to Fort Worth.
What's your take of Frank Kaufman? I had an opportunity to interview him 10 years ago. He's dead now.
Yes.
And he claimed that he was one of the first on the crash site, that
yes.
he saw the alien bodies. Yet, of all the witnesses, he's the one where a lot of people say may have fabricated his story. What's your take on that?
Well, we were the ones who exposed that part of it. We found documents in his very office. His wife, Juanita, was still, you know, talking with us.
Mm-hmm.
We were allowed, you know, into his office where we went through drawers and we found a satchel that was tucked behind a drawer. And there we discovered all these original documents that clearly described something else, that he wasn't who he originally said he was. You could see that they were cut and pasted up as far as documents that he was presenting us, suggesting that he was part of this recovery team. And as a result, we had to obviously disavow this, you know, disregard.
Why would he do that? I mean, did he profit from this at all?
To some degree, but that therein still remains the mystery, George. His grandson, for example, who in his final weeks as he was dying of cancer, described phone calls from a Captain Henderson from Texas who was still warning him about talking. And then both the grandson and his late wife Juanita described how all of a sudden a car pulls up to the house one particular day during, you know, the time that Frank is withering down to, you know, about 100 pounds and the cancer is taking its toll on his health. And an officer, Air Force officer, comes to the door and practically walks in and knows exactly where Frank's bedroom is located and then spends a half hour with the door closed, comes out, sits in the family room, doesn't say a word, gets up, and then leaves. It's all rather bizarre,
yes.
You know, final, you know, behavior on the part of the government, especially for someone who, if anything, was misleading, was deceiving, was diverting us in many ways. But as Frank told us, right after he got out of the hospital, where he was sent home basically to spend his remaining
days, yeah.
He said, "Don, the game continues." And then he repeated it, "The game continues." Whose game?
Whose game? Maybe his. Who knows?
Maybe his, but it appears that he was following someone else's lead.
We also asked him, you know, what's the game plan here? And I think Don remembers this. He said their game plan is to run out the clock. And that means to just wait it out till everybody's gone. That's what the game plan is.
Well, and they're trying to do that, except they failed to put into consideration historians like you, too.
We like to believe that. We like to believe that we're the one fly in the ointment.
Was there, during this episode, 47, did they go do, and I know, you know, I was out there for the 60th anniversary, and it's pretty widespread, but was there an effort to keep neighbors shut from saying anything?
There was a monumental effort, and I think that our investigation in the last 10 years has one thing that we've really brought out is the extreme efforts that were employed by the Air Force to shut people up. Today, they would be called civil rights violations, George. But back in 1947, the military of the United States was held in high esteem. They had just won World War II. They were in our country's highest esteem, and whatever they said sort of was okay with people. But what happened here was they employed brutal tactics, especially with people who knew or saw the bodies, who saw the bodies or knew about the bodies that were recovered. Those were the ones that were marked for special attention. And the ranchers up north of town, they went into their homes, they turned the floorboards upside down looking for pieces of wreckage. They cut open meal sacks, they drained the water tanks, they looked everywhere, just turned the homes upside down looking for pieces of wreckage. The civilians who knew about the bodies in Roswell, they would take the children into one room and the parents into another room, and they would tell each that they would kill the other if they talked. This we have more stories like that since our first book was written of parents who were scared to death because they have been threatened with not only their lives, but more so their children's lives. Who would think of doing that over a weather balloon? But we have testimony, lots of testimony to that.
And I think therein, too, would suggest one of the reasons, continuing for the cover-up, the culpability, the people who are responsible, the fact that such tactics were even employed 62 years ago.
Yeah, you would think never, but it did happen.
Yes.
It did.
We have no doubt.
Tell me about the bodies again that Walter Hout had testified to in his affidavit.
Well, he described, I think the first time that he actually suggested that he knew more about the bodies than he was letting on to is just in small talk conversation in his office at the museum. And we just point blank, Walter, how tall did Butch, Colonel Blanchard, say the bodies were? And his arm shot out about shoulder height. And it was like, oops. And
yeah.
Okay, so it's like, gotcha. And then proceeded to ask him a few more details about the body. And he finally acknowledged that, well, Blanchard did tell him. Well, as it turns out, he allowed him to actually go to the hangar, the big hangar, as they always called it, P3, which is Building 84. And Walter, in his statement, described how he not only saw the object, the craft, which was about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, about the same shape, egg shape, and he described seeing a number of the bodies on their canvas cover. And they looked like they were child-sized. But he saw the heads extending out from beneath and much larger, much disproportionately larger than the rest of the bodies. He said it was rather dark, rather shadowy, but still, he no doubt. I think it was one of the reasons that even not admitting anything, Walter was always quick to say he was convinced it was a flying saucer. It was extraterrestrial. He stated that for the last 30 years of his life. He had no doubt.
And that's an amazing story, just by his admission alone.
And for those who now still try to suggest that he was not in full faculty and that he was not capable of making such a pronouncement, we had full clearance from his doctors that it was a good time to do this. That this was even 3 years before he passed away. And I had the good fortune of seeing Walter just weeks before he died, 3 years later, 3 years after he did the signed statement. And he still knew me. He still recognized me. He still even kidded with me. So I'm sorry. It's easy to, cast doubt from people who never even met the man. But for those of us who did, he left us all the more convinced that something truly extraordinary happened.
Was there, Don, any discussions with Dr. J. Allen Hynek while he was alive about Roswell?
Not specifically Roswell, but a number of other possible crash incidents. But what truly surprised us when Dr. Hynek passed away in 1986 and we were going through his personal files, we were surprised that we had known that Northwestern University had willed him an old observatory in the western part of New Mexico. It's one of the reasons that Dr. Hynek moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, you know, within that area, just the last 2 years of his life. And we discovered that in his trips to New Mexico, he was talking to some of the Roswell witnesses. He was talking to some of Mac Brazel's neighbors. And they were recounting in the same detail they would later describe to us precisely what happened. And in Dr. Hynek's notes, this needs to be followed up. This person needs to be talked to again. We need to do something about this. Well, he ran out of time. And there, too, I mean, as almost another voice from the grave that he was beckoning. He was encouraging us to follow up in his footsteps. And in many ways, he was the one who served as an inspiration for us to follow up on Roswell.
His turnaround, because of his work as a consultant with Project Blue Book,
yes,
and then his turnaround into believing, I think was pretty dramatic.
It was, considering that he was the Air Force's chief debunker for all those years.
He was the swamp gas guy.
He was, and he never lived that down. And as far as the Dexter Ann Arbor sightings in Michigan at that time, He only intended that to address one specific sighting, not the entire rash wave of sightings at that time. But nonetheless, the press even continued to bring that up. But there was that transition, and it was another case in New Mexico, the Socorro case involving Lonnie Zamora, the police officer, and the actual landing, the physical traces on the ground, and even the very last time that I was with Dr. Hynek, and I will never forget his pounding his fist on the table and going, "Don, it's smacking more and more of nuts and bolts." So beyond even as an astronomer dealing with the tremendous distances from star to star, he accepted the fact that there was a physical interaction. There was something physical that was coming into our very airspace and interacting with the witnesses. And that was just extremely dramatic, that he was enough of a scientist that he not only admitted he was wrong, but he couldn't have, you know, been more outspoken about the fact that there was something truly, you know, extraordinary going on.
You see, when debunkers talk about UFOs and their fact that they don't believe in it, that's one of the greatest stories, I think, of convincing people that UFOs exist, and it's the Dr. J. Allen Hynek turnaround story.
The transition.
Yes.
And for someone who was hands-on involved, and one of the things that he often said, he often described to us, is that it became quite evident early on, especially with Blue Book, that the hardcore, as he would describe them, cases, were going upstairs. They were not part of Blue Book.
And hence the revision. We'll talk about it. Witness to Roswell when we come right back. Why did you two decide then to rewrite and revise the book Witness to Roswell? Tom?
Well, the first edition, the 2007 edition, did so well, and it was received so highly. We got the idea, well, let's do it again. But that was only part of it, George. We had accumulated more information since the first book came out. So it was a combination of we didn't get enough information in the first book that we wanted to because of page constrictions, and new information that we did glean since the publication. So we thought, let's put out another book, but we insisted that it be larger and that it would inc- include the most up-to-date information that we had. And so that's what we did.
Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who wrote your foreword, the new one, is from Roswell, isn't he?
Yes. I believe he was born not in Roswell, but he grew up in his early years in Roswell and went to grade school in Roswell. And then his family moved to Artesia, which is just south of Roswell, where he went to high school. But he considers himself a Roswell person, as we do.
Don, tell me about the new witnesses.
Well, we've been focusing on securing more and more deathbed testimony. And one of the things that continues to surprise us is that, as Tom was describing in the last hour, that these are, in most cases, reluctant witnesses. They're people that...
They prefer you not approach them.
Their immediate response typically is, how did you find me?
Mm-hmm.
Who told you about me? Who, even suggested that I was even there in 1947?
They ever say, I'm dying, leave me alone?
Well, we've had people slam the phones down.
You have, yeah.
We've had people that when we've gone to, we'll even arrive unannounced where we'll come to your home. And we have techniques. More times than not, we'll be invited in and certain information will be divulged. But again, we feel very compelled that if we don't do it, nobody will. And so we're focusing on a lot of the younger recruits from that time. And that's why we're focusing, like Ed Sain, for example. He was an MP with the 390th Air Service Squadron, and which was attached to the 509th Atomic Bomb Squad at that time.
Okay.
And the 390th, they typically had a top security clearance, and he would admit before he passed away that he was one of the guards out at the body site north of town. So because we find that the 390th was involved, then we focus on other members of that squadron. And then we have Eli Benjamin, who was also a member of the 390th.
And what do they generally say?
Well, they invariably mention the little people. The little men.
This is incredible.
And much to their credit, they don't call them E.T., they don't call them spacemen, they don't call them, little green men. They describe them in the vernacular of the time. And they refer to, people that clearly, as one of them said, they sure weren't from Texas. But they're haunted by it. I started to mention Eli Benjamin. He was a private first class with the 390th. And it was actually his wife that first described how it's something that has haunted him all these years. In fact, such that they sleep in separate bedrooms.
Really?
Because he still, bolts up during the middle of the night, and he's haunted by the face. He's haunted by what he saw at the base hospital.
Got that close.
When he was merely told, get your gun, report over to the big hangar, and then he escorted a number of vehicles over to the hospital and then actually saw what the cargo being transported was. When he first told us, when he first described to us the body, he wept.
And this is Eli.
He cried. This is Eli Benjamin. He cried. In other words, after all these years, it's something that still, brings out his emotion. And it isn't that he saw something that horrible, that unearthly. It's just something that to this day is something that's foreign.
Well, I think, Don and Tom, when you are faced with the fact that whatever you're looking at is truly extraterrestrial, truly from another world, whether it be just the craft or the bodies, which would be even more dramatic, I think it would be emotional. I've been doing this for years now, and investigating this ever since my mother gave me a book called We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan. And then Look Magazine did the Barney and Betty Hill story. I've been obsessed with this. And even at this point where I think I am insulated, where I've seen it all, I mean, I saw eight people being carried out of a house in Detroit when I covered a murder there of eight people.
We'll never forget
you
that.
Know, but you become immune to stuff like that, okay? I would come on the scene of people who were dead in a car crash, and they'd still be behind the wheel, smashed. You become immune to that. But I think if I saw alien bodies, it would be emotional for me. I wouldn't be scared, but it would be so dramatic for me because that tells you so many things about the answers that we've all been looking for. What's in the universe? What could be out there? I think I'd be overcome. I really do. So I can't blame these people for doing this.
And so unprecedented. I mean, they just, you know, survived the worst horrors of World War II. They were just happy to be, you know, back in the States and rejoin their families and get on with their lives. But that also, you know, emphasizes the character that, you know, existed with all these people, the Greatest Generation. For anybody who ever suggests that we're not ready, we're not mature enough, well, what about the people back in 1947, as we've been describing, who actually saw, who handled, and didn't rush into the streets and panic?
What did Eli think? Did he have his own conclusions of what he might have been looking at?
Oh, no doubt. I mean that it was clearly something off the planet, that he was clearly dealing with something alien.
His Eli's term for them was species. He called it the species.
And we still don't know if they were androids or, you know, part human, part robot. We don't know that, do we?
But I think, no, we don't. And I think overall, though, what also shocked most of the witnesses is the childlike quality, the expression on the faces, the size, as Walter Hott, even in his sealed statement. At first, he thought he was looking at children under those canvas tarps. One of the secretary to the hospital administrator, when she was taken into one of the examination rooms, her name was Miriam Bush, and her first reaction is, my God, they're children. And then she saw the head.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Don, wasn't she haunted for the rest of her life
rest
by the eyes?
Rest of her life.
Big eyes, the big black eyes.
The big, the large staring eyes. And she would commit suicide, or so the police report, most recently in 1989.
Oh, no.
And yet the manner by which she supposedly committed suicide was by wrapping a plastic bag over her head.
That sounds like a murder to me.
It certainly does, and I've talked to many people within law enforcement
Nobody.
Who have never heard.
No.
Because at any moment you can just pull it off as you're struggling and gasping for your last breath. And according to her late brother George and his wife Pat and another sister, there were bruises and scratch marks all over her arms. So it's something we'll look into a little further.
Yeah, that's worthy of that.
But we have other such stories, yes.
Well, the one back to Eli Benjamin again, and what did he ever say that he's convinced that these are ETs? And did they ever speculate on where they think they came from?
George, we regarding Eli, he was certainly convinced that it was extraterrestrial. That's why he called it species rather than even a little person. He called it a species, which meant to him it was something foreign.
And he is dead now?
No.
Oh, he's still alive.
Still alive, yes.
Okay.
And the second part of that was what?
Where they came from.
Oh, yeah. George, we're asked that all the time. And Don and I, our mandate is to prove one way or the other what happened in 1947. We leave the speculation as to where they were from to others. And Don can correct me. I don't think we've ever spoken, have we, Don, about where they were from?
No, because we're so focused.
I know Stanton does that.
Yes, and that certainly is his prerogative, and we admire and respect him for that. But we're dealing with eyewitness testimony. And even for those who would debate in dealing with elderly memories of an event of this nature, I challenge, as we often do, any of your listeners who were alive on November 22nd of 1963, who all will remember precisely what we were doing and where we were at that time when John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Exactly.
And we were not there. We were not involved. To suggest that back in 47, the very people who saw firsthand should ever forget as just describing Eli Benjamin and still being haunted by seeing the face, seeing one of the bodies, is to discredit and insult really all of us. And that's where we come in. That's why we devote most of our time to just finding these people and providing them with an opportunity to finally go on the record.
Regarding the reactions, George, there was a fellow, Earl Fulford, who is mentioned quite extensively in both of our books, the current one and the previous one. Unfortunately, Fulford passed away last August at age 82. But he was very helpful, and regarding the reaction of the base personnel, he said that it ran from everything from so what to grown men crying. And he did emphasize that the most emotional reactions were from the younger troops, fellas 18, 19, 20 years old.
Really?
Yes.
Emotional in terms of excitement or just panic or what?
Combination of panic, disbelief, and not knowing what was happening to their belief system, because this was the greatest generation in our country's history. The traditional values, belief in mother, God, and apple pie, and when they saw these things that were obviously not from this earth, the younger fellows just completely lost it. Not in every case, but the ones who did lose it tended to be the younger fellows.
Now, we didn't shoot these craft down, did we?
Speculation again that Don and I don't engage in. We've heard, was it shot down? Was it radar that brought it down? Our belief, and it's basically by deduction, was that we know that there was a severe thunder and lightning storm that night. Many witnesses have told us that. And if you've ever been in New Mexico in July, it's what they call the monsoon season. I know I've never seen lightning like that.
We were supposed to take a plane when we went to the 60th anniversary and we did a live program that Friday night. We were supposed to take a plane into Roswell after we landed in Albuquerque, and we decided, no, we're going to take a car. So they had a car pick us up at the airport, and because they wanted us to go in this little tiny single-engine thing. And I'm glad we took the car, because the storms that period, if you remember, were unbelievable, and we would have been flying right into it.
You were very wise.
Yep.
Taking the advice of the professional people who realized that the storms come up so quickly off the mountains from the heat of the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And even as far as being out in the high desert area, you don't want to be trapped out there. The lightning will even strike and totally inflame, an entire hillside and rage completely out of control, especially during the drought periods leading up to the rainy season. So one can well imagine that any aircraft whether, you know, from here or not, caught in one of those storms. And as we're hearing now with the Air France, you know, crash off of South America, that planes are struck by lightning all the time. But, again, not knowing what the propulsion was, as often assumed that the craft was propelled by electromagnetism, that would be the worst of combinations, a lightning bolt and electromagnetic propulsion. So it indeed may have been the very reason that the craft broke up and that impacted.
Why is there still an incredible fascination with Roswell, you two?
Well, the it's first of all, it's the most widely reported case. There have been umpteen documentaries done on TV about it. I don't know how many books. I would imagine hundreds of books about Roswell incident. It's also, from my own perspective, the most interesting UFO case going. It's got everything. It's not a will of the wisp that somebody saw in the night sky. We're talking about, as Don mentioned earlier, a nuts and bolts case. We're talking about a physical craft with real bodies and a cover-up, and it's still a mystery, and it's absolute proof, if the case is true, that we have been visited by someone from not from this earth. So you combine all those facets, and to me, I can only speak for me, it's the most interesting UFO case of all time, and it's held my interest for 18 years. I'm as interested today in it as I was when I started investigating this in 1991. I get a new witness. Don will email me a new witness lead. I get a chill still down my back.
And off you go. And you have come to the point now, too, then, where you conclude that these were of extraterrestrial origin, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There can be no other conclusion drawn. There is not a single witness to a balloon event in Mac Brazel's pasture. Not a single witness. And we have over 600 first, second, and third-hand witnesses to an extraterrestrial event. Each one of those doesn't know the whole story, George. They only know a little snippet.
Yep, their little piece.
Their little piece, and it's Don's job and it's my job to put those little pieces into a puzzle, into a, you know, a framework that makes sense. And that's what our mandate is.
When we come back, let's talk about this incredible memory metal that you were talking about, and also through this new work, let's go through some of the new people that you've talked to or new information that you've picked up. For example, the Air Force hitman, Hunter Penn. Why was he in Roswell? We'll talk about that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Let me throw out some of the new folks that you interviewed and then tell me a little bit about what you uncovered with them, of course. And then we'll talk about the memory metal as well, which is really, as you, Tom, and Don say, you're trying to get information about. Because, let me tell you, aluminum foil doesn't unfold like that, does it?
No. Aluminum foil is like your Hershey bar. Just crumples up, it stays crumpled.
Yep, exactly. All right, the Air Force hitman, Hunter Penn. Tell me about him.
Well, this Hunter Penn was a witness that our friend Anthony Bergaglia, a independent investigator in Florida, uncovered. Hunter Penn is long dead, but he spoke with his daughter. And Hunter Penn, to use a hockey vernacular, was a goon or an enforcer, if you know the sport of hockey.
I knew Tony Twist. I still do, of course, from the Blues. So that's what he did.
He was the Tony Twist of the Air Force.
Yep, okay.
Whenever they needed a job that required a heavy hand, Hunter Penn was their man. And Roswell was the case for him. And they sent Hunter Penn. This was after the initial round of threats had been administered and the case had been killed in the press, and things had got gotten back to as normal as they could in the wake of the Roswell incident. They sent Hunter Penn to Roswell to reinforce the threats that were administered earlier. And he went around, especially to the ranchers. And according to his daughter, he was really a fanatic about weapons and things like that. And according to her, he really liked ice picks. And she thinks that he used an ice pick at Roswell. That's her statement. But he was the fellow that they sent to reinforce the silence.
Well, it worked.
It worked.
It worked. In fact, there was a serviceman that came onto the base. He was stationed there in December of 1947, and he described to us there was still a lot of buzz of everything that had gone down at the big hangar. And he said what really soured him on a military career was the MPs were still talking about how rough they got with the ranchers north of town. And he said they were bragging about it. So, again, it would appear to be rather extreme, you know, reaction on their part as far as a weather balloon recovery.
Air Force pilot Ben Gaines.
Ben Gaines was a witness. He's still alive. Discovered by a reporter in Sarasota, Florida named Billy Cox. And we interviewed Gaines, and what he was the personal pilot in 1947 of Lawrence Craigie, who worked for General LeMay, Curtis LeMay.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, LeMay was the head of Air Force R&D, Research and Development, and Lawrence Craigie was the head of Research and Engineering. According to Gaines, he flew Craigie, General Craigie, to Roswell at the time of the Roswell crash. He didn't know why they were going. He just had the orders to fly him. And they landed in Roswell. Craigie said to Gaines, get lost, which meant that Gaines headed for the officers' club.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that Gaines overheard all the other officers talking about this flying saucer crash north of town and the little people that were recovered. So, Gaines also said that the orders were when they returned, when Craigie returned from his meeting with General Blanchard, and he looked at the craft and the bodies, which he did not tell Gaines about, but his orders were to fly Craigie directly back to President Truman and not go back to Wright Field. So that's just a little, you know, one of those little stories that someone has told us, but it fits in with the rest of the tapestry.
Good job. Life Magazine's photojournalist, Alan Grant, you talk about him.
Well, Alan Grant was a Life Magazine, as you say, photojournalist, and his is a strange story. He got orders from his boss to fly to Roswell, that there was some sort of meteor crash. And that's all he had was that there was a meteor crash out there or something. And he had just had relocated from New York to Los Angeles to be near the movie scene. And here he is on a plane. He lands in Albuquerque, and he's met by an Air Force major. And he's told, well, let's go. And there was a single engine trainer plane waiting for them, and they took off and they flew for about half an hour, and they landed out in the desert. And so they get out of the plane, and the major says, "Here, Mr. Grant, I'm supposed to give you this," and he handed him a 45 automatic with a holster and one of those clips that go around your waist. So he says, what do I need this for? He says, well, we don't know. We don't know what we're going to find. So he puts the gun on, and a Jeep is waiting. They drive out into the desert, and according to Grant, they didn't find anything. So the question is, what was this all about? it was either a case where the Air Force hadn't yet got its act together, and at some point they said, well, we don't want him near this site, so they drove him off into nowhere. Or it was a case, according to Grant's surviving widow, that the Air Force, it was a big ruse so that they could tell the other news organizations, well, Life magazine is already on this, so don't even bother. And if that's the case, it worked, because no other news agency or publication investigated the case, because Life magazine was on it. And for Alan Grant, it was a wild goose chase.
Tell me about the midget story of the jailhouse surprising an officer.
Well, this was another faux pas where a JAG officer, a Judge Advocate General legal officer in Washington, was flown to Roswell, and he didn't know why he was going out there. He said, "Just report to the base, and they'll tell you what to do." So this JAG officer flies out there, and they say, "Oh yes sir, follow me," and they take him first over to the big hangar, and he sees this wreckage inside the big hangar. For it's the UFO wreckage, and he sees these things under on a gurney under a sheet. He couldn't make out what they were, so he says, what is this? What am I doing here? What do I have to do with this? And he says, "Follow me, sir. My orders are to take you over to the jail, the brig." So they take him over to the brig. And they say over here, I guess he was a lieutenant or captain, they take him over to this jail cell, and he sees this little creature in army fatigues that are way oversized for it. And he doesn't know at this point. He doesn't know what's going on. He says, "What am I supposed to do with this?" And he said, wait a minute, sir. And someone comes running in. "Oh my goodness, you're not the one." So it was somebody else that they were supposed to show all this to. And so they hustle him out of there. And he was wondering for the rest of his days in the Air Force what that was all about. Well, apparently, you could suppose that was the one that was alive that they were keeping in a holding tank until they decided what to do with it.
Where is it now? Where do you think?
Well, we have testimony that a survivor from a number of firsthand sources, including Eli Benjamin, who we discussed earlier, saw it at the base hospital. We have witnesses who saw a live one out at the very impact site north of town.
Right.
And we have testimony such as Black Mac Magruder, who saw it even a year later at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. But that's where the chain of activity pretty much comes to an end. We don't know. There's a lot of talk about it only survived for a short period of time thereafter, or even survived into the 50s. But that's, again, part of the rumor mill. But up until at least 1948, we do have eyewitness testimony describing the survivor.
You would have thought that there would have been a rescue mission from wherever they came.
Well, there was talk about an infiltration. In fact, even Nathan Twining's son, Nathan Twining Jr.,
right,
described hearing from one of his father's aides about an infiltration over Wright Field within a week after the incident, that an object, that in fact it was a scramble of this unknown that came over the base at that time. And then even a couple of months later, when Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, the famous meteor expert from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, was assigned from Washington. He arrived in Roswell, and a non-commissioned CIC officer, Master Sergeant Lewis Ricketts, was assigned to spend a number of weeks with him in the field. And their job was to determine the speed and trajectory of this so-called weather balloon. Well, needless to say, as they were interviewing a lot of the ranchers north of town in this general area, they learned that quite a few of them were describing seeing unknown objects hovering over some of the ranches, some of the outlying high desert pasture land with spotlights, with searchlights
beaming
to the ground, as though they were looking for something. And it wasn't any of our aircraft at that time. So it was clearly both Rickett and La Paz's conclusion that they were looking for their downed comrades, so to speak.
I wonder why they never got involved militarily with us to a point. I mean, there may have been some skirmishes, and we've all heard little stories, but just a huge outward, you know, attack. I guess they're not into that.
No, and it would appear as though that's probably the reason they're so curious, so interested in the fact that we can't even get along with our own families.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as Stanton often points this out, that just any outside intelligence monitoring our daily radio and TV broadcast, and what is the dominant theme that comes across, you know, just day after day, hour after hour. And is it any wonder that they don't land on the White House front lawn and, you know, make themselves, you know, their presence known? Because our first reaction would be to shoot and recover and dissect.
Sergeant William Ennis, who was he?
Well, Ennis was with the 393rd Bomb Squadron at that time, and he actually was an engineer who worked at T3, Building 84. And the first time Kevin Randall and I found and interviewed him, he was one of those reluctant witnesses. And until last year, even to his own son, he stated, you know, just over and over again, it was just the weather balloon. And we had talked about, and Tom had mentioned Sergeant Earl Fulford, who had actually been part of the recovery team. Well, we arranged for the two of them to meet last July in Roswell and share some memories, get reacquainted.
Sure.
And after they spent a couple hours together in private, and we were allowed to rejoin them, and we asked Sergeant Ennis, well, what can you tell us now? He immediately said, well, whatever Earl's telling you, it happened. And then in subsequent meetings, he finally admitted it was a spaceship. From a weather balloon to it now actually being from off the planet. And then he looked at us and said, before I go, I just want you boys to figure out how that thing flew. It didn't have a moving part on it.
He didn't know, did he?
No. Though we still believe there's more information. And in fact, when we make our next trip to Roswell, we certainly intend on paying him another visit, because as long as we still have a shot, we'll try to get some final information from him.
What's your take, both of you, on Philip Corso, the late Philip Corso's story, the colonel?
Well, Philip Corso, I believe he was a retired lieutenant colonel. My view is that he had a full life. He had an important life. Why would he, if what he was saying was not there wasn't something to it, why would he come forward like that and tell a story like that? So on the one hand, he has bona fides that support what he was doing. On the other hand, there are things in the book that we just don't agree with, and I have mixed views of Corso. It's interesting that you mention him, because most everybody that we interview but the people we talk to that when we're in Roswell and we do book signings and things like that, the one book that they all seem to have read is the Corso book. And they wonder why we never put the mentioned Corso in our book. And our answer is that I think we're still, I'm still puzzled. I'm still puzzled by him.
It is strange.
I think we had mentioned, you had brought up Frank Kaufman. And we talked about, you know, our having exposed him at least for being a forger of documents. And if you go back to Corso's book The Day After, the very first chapter is basically the Frank Kaufman story. I mean, it reads right out of his very playbook. And if we have to discount Kaufman, then it would cast some doubt on Corso as well.
Tell me about a deathbed confession from a Roswell chaplain.
The Roswell chaplain, Elijah Hankerson, is another witness that Anthony Bregaglia found. And he's not we have this yearbook from 1947 that has the pictures of approximately 3,000 airmen from the base. And it's only about one-half to one-third of the total complement at Roswell. Well, Hankerson is not in the yearbook, but he is in the 1947 telephone directory for Roswell. So that establishes that he was actually there. He was the base chaplain in 1947. And Bregaglia figured, well, chaplains, they are ones that comfort the sick and comfort the deceased, the relatives of the deceased, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a good chance that he was out at the crash site. So Bregaglia interviewed Hankerson's daughter, and it turned out that she was stunned. It's a long story how he found her. I won't go into that. But she was stunned that her parents were ever stationed at Roswell. They were career Army Air Force. They mentioned all of the other bases to them where that they had lived, but they never mentioned Roswell. And they were stunned to find out that they were there. And it made sense to them. Some of the strange statements that Elijah Hankerson made on his deathbed. There are many houses in my father's universe. I'm just a man. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Things like that. They could not make out, what is he saying? Well, it turns out that he was, as the Roswell incident progressed, by a few days, we're now talking a few days after it started, Hankerson was precipitously removed from his position, and another chaplain was brought in, a Catholic priest. And as you know, a Catholic priest can take confession and things like that. So the idea being that perhaps Hankerson lost it. When this happened.
Let's talk about the Memory Medal and take phone calls next hour. Tom, in Donna's story we have posted at coasttocoastam.com, talks about a scientist for the Battelle Memorial Institute, Dr. Howard C. Cross, and apparently he might have been under contract to study this Memory Medal. What do you think of that?
Well, let's give a little background to Battelle, which,
okay,
you know, first it started in 1929. It specialized in advanced research and development and the commercialization of, you know, technological breakthroughs, including life sciences and engineering, national security, but most specifically materials. And it worked very closely with Wright Field in 1947. In Wright Field, you had the Foreign Technology Division, which did reverse engineering on captured weaponry and armory from World War II. So it's just next door in Columbus, Ohio, and Wright Field being in Dayton. So it was the leading government contractor, and it also manages six other national laboratories. I mention all that because I was invited to speak at Battelle in January of 1994, and in front of a sellout crowd, over 800 people. And I will never, and I mean, to talk about Roswell.
Yeah.
And I will never forget how the entire first couple rows of the theater were all Battelle scientists taking notes. So what were they still hoping to glean as far as new information on Roswell that I was presenting that night that they didn't already know, as it turns out? And now you describe as far as the documents that we relate in the book, again discovered by our colleague Anthony Regalia, suggesting that they were definitely researching memory material, self-healing material, back in 1947. And Tom will continue as far as exactly what their conclusions were and what they were able to develop at that time.
Yes, Tony Bregaglia, a few years ago, started looking into what became of the Roswell wreckage after it went to Wright Field in July of 47. And he discovered scientific research papers written in the 1960s and 70s that referenced a Battelle Institute Second Progress Report with a date of 1949 relating to the studies of nickel and titanium. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Today, nickel and titanium are used to produce a metal known as nitinol, N-I-T-I-N-O-L.
It's an alloy, isn't it?
It's an alloy. And in essence, it's memory metal, suggesting that the Air Force, we have the contract number, Tony has the contract number, that they farmed out to Battelle Institute to research nickel and titanium. This had never been done before. The contract went out presumably right after the Roswell wreckage had been brought in, because the second progress report from Battelle to Wright-Patterson has a 1949 date on it. It also presupposes that there was a first progress report, presumably done in 1948. So you add that together, and it looks like the Air Force tried to re-engineer successfully memory metal. The alloy itself was introduced to the public in 1962 by the Naval Ordnance Lab, which is the NOL in nitinol. So there are scientific references to the second progress report that Tony has found on scientific papers. These are refereed metallurgical papers that were done in the 60s and 70s, all citing the Wright-Patterson contract number to Battelle Institute to do this work on re-engineering the memory metal.
It is so amazing.
Now, keep in mind that the late General Arthur Exon, who was at Foreign Technology Division at the time of the incident, they were getting ready for the materials coming in from Roswell. And upon first arrival and first look, they thought the materials had to be Soviet because it didn't look like anything domestic.
Mm-hmm.
And that after it was tested, as he described to us, that it was of unanimous consensus that the materials were from outer space. So
Exxon also said that he now Exxon was the commander at Wright-Patt in 1964-65.
64, right, yeah.
And he said that he was told by the people who actually worked on this material, because Exxon, even though he's the best commander, didn't have the clearance to actually see this material, but he was told that the metal was some form of pure titanium and another metal, which made up the alloy.
That is
so amazing. We now know the other metal was nickel. So the Air Force then contracting this out to Battelle to research nickel and titanium. The conclusion is that the Air Force labs were able to determine the metallic structure, but they didn't have the equipment, the wherewithal, to do further. other research, and that's why they farmed it out to Battelle.
Now, most specifically, though, that the combination of titanium and nickel and the right pat assignment to Battelle was specifically for the development of shape recovery metal. They had combined nickel and titanium in the past, even previous to World War II, but it wasn't for that purpose. There's nothing that would demonstrate that we had memory materials of any sort during World War II.
Richard Hoagland wants to know if this could have been the DuPont-manufactured aluminized Mylar from the 40s. But again, I don't think that comes back to its original properties.
No, and Mylar you can cut and you can drill through and you can burn. It doesn't match, again, what any of the witnesses are describing.
Let's go to some of the phones. Let's go to Los Angeles. Christian, first-time caller, you're on. Hi there.
Hello, Christian. Can you guys hear me?
Sure thing.
Absolutely.
I got a question. I've been fascinated with the Roswell incident for quite a long time. And I think that, you know, we really have to thank Stanton Friedman because he's really, I think, the one who opened all of this up to all of us. My question is that the author of the book, The Day After Roswell, Philip Curzo. Would you say that he would probably be fraudulent because, as Stanton Friedman says, that he has a lot of trouble comparing what he says with, you know, a lot of what the eyewitness testimony about the crash site and all, it kind of conflicts. So would you think that Curzo probably could have been deliberately by the CIA sent out there to kind of muck the water up and confuse people? And my second question is, after all of these years, where do you think the debris, the actual craft that was found at Roswell and recovered, and also, let's say, the extraterrestrial entities, the bodies, where do you think all of this is now? I mean, obviously, it's being housed in a top-secret military installation, probably under cold storage somewhere. But kind of that's my question, and thank you for your time.
Well, we thank you.
All right, let's take the second one first, the debris. Area 51, where might it be?
Well, we've had first-hand witnesses not only at Battelle, but also at RAND Corporation, General Electric, Hughes Aircraft, the Bureau of Standards, all describing, and that's one of the things that in the Corso book, it was accurate in describing the assimilation into the private sector. The government, the military doesn't manufacture anything. You know, every tank, every plane, every, you know, M16 automatic rifle is all manufactured in the private sector. So that part of it was certainly correct. So we can only assume that as they've attempted reverse engineering, they've piecemealed it, they've sent it out wherever they could. And with the Nittinol discovery, it may have been that Battelle was the first one that actually came up with the combination of two metals that became an alloy that is actually applicable, something that has been developed for future use. As far as the bodies, you certainly would preserve unique specimens. It's just a question of where. The ongoing speculation is still Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. There are multiple levels beneath the ground. And, in fact, we've even been told that there's a cement vault under the nuclear reactor on the base. And why would they have such a locker, so to speak, under the very reactor at the facility. Be a perfect hiding place.
And then, of course, Corso. Back to him for just a moment. Bill Burns, whom I know quite well because he's a partner with me in a couple books, he wrote The Day After Roswell with Corso, believes the story. Again, we don't really know the motivation of why Corso decided to come forward. Corso was who he says he was. The question is, did he do what he said he did?
I think what I find the most curious, and it's at no fault of either Burns or even Corso, the book came out at the very time that the Pentagon had their anthropomorphic wooden crash dummy press conference. just before the 50th anniversary in 1997. And here you have a high-ranking officer firsthand describing not only, you know, being party to the reverse engineering, but actually having seen the bodies. And you might remember yourself, George, none of the major media touched the story.
True.
The only program that we recall that even did a segment on Corso was NBC's Dateline. And it was a hatchet job. So, I wonder who was behind it all. And if there was some ulterior motive as far as what purpose, what agenda the Corso was unwillingly used for, and if it was just to further muddy the waters at the time that they were coming out with their fourth explanation in 1997.
Let's go to West Haven, Connecticut. Ronnie, you're up with us.
George, hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
What I want to know is, other than the cave drawings that we've seen of men from space, where did this start, like at the beginning, before Roswell? When you hear of these sightings, believe me, I'm ex-military 10 years, and I'm surprised you didn't mention my company in those companies that do those projects for the government, PerkinElmer. You just don't throw three Chinook helicopters, ground forces, and all that stuff together lickety-split like they do. There's got to be some previous communication. I'm going to hang up. I want to hear your response.
Okay. Who wants it? Don, Tom?
I didn't quite understand the question.
Well, I think he was suggesting that you wouldn't have...
They were ready for this.
...a recovery operation at the ready at the time of the crash. And we've always concluded that it's actually this simple. Obviously, New Mexico was the hotbed of military research and testing at that time, and I'm often amazed, especially when one lectures on college campuses, when you propose the question, where was the first atomic bomb detonated, how many professors say Japan. They don't even know that it was right in New Mexico.
True.
And as a result, with all that testing and with that first atomic bomb, even in General Leslie Groves' memoirs, he talks about confrontations with Robert Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer constantly questioning who all these other personnel were, all these other people. And as it turns out, it was Groves' S1 unit. So in other words, they had people already assigned in place in the event of any of this getting out of hand. If there would have been an atomic accident, if there would have been a bomb, you know, blast that needed to be contained and covered up, they had officers, they had doctors and nurses, everybody in place. And so we believe, just for the fact that there were a lot of outside personnel who immediately came into Roswell, people who were normally assigned to the base hospital, and they talk about all the unknown doctors and nurses who all of a sudden arrived on the scene. Who were these people? We think it was these very people who were there in the event of an atomic accident, minus the atomic accident. And in place of it was the crash of an actual flying saucer. That was the recovery team. These were the people that were on the standby should something have happened of this nature. And they were the most proficient, most efficient in covering up and containing this, and they got away with it for 30 years.
Why the cover-up? What are they afraid of?
Well, you mean why it's still covered up?
Yeah. What are they afraid of?
Well, number one, it could be they're still ignorant for the most part of what it is they have. Maybe outside of the nitinol, which looks promising, but it's a cover up of ignorance. Also, George, when you get a cover up, you start a cover up, it tends to get sometimes a life of its own. We cover it up today because it was always covered up, and there's no one with the interest or the courage to challenge it. I know if you're in the Air Force, one way not to advance your career is to go up to your commanding officer and say, hey, Colonel, how about that Roswell incident? That's not going to get you to the next rank. And the primary interest, if you're a career person, is to get to the next rank. So making waves will not do it. So there would be a price to pay for anybody in the military to try to look into this. Barry Goldwater, former senator from New Mexico. And
He tried,
and he got a chewing out. And this is he's a former general and a former senator. He got chewed out by General LeMay. Don't ever do that again, and if you do, I'll court-martial you. This is a U.S. senator. So it's not something that will advance your career. And politically, there would be a price to pay for anyone if this was revealed tomorrow. That, hey, folks, we've been lying to you for 62 years. Here's the stuff. Somebody is going to pay a price for that.
You continue to investigate, Tom and Don. You're not going to give up, are you?
We are on this case, George, until either the last witness goes or we go, or more hopefully we solve it to everyone's satisfaction, and we can then move on to another case. But we're on this until for the duration.
We'll take final calls in a second. Where do you get the book, Witness to Roswell?
The book is available at Amazon, of course, and at Barnes & Noble, Borders, and your local bookstores.
Website?
www.roswellinvestigator.com.
When you go to Roswell, what do people say to both of you? They greet you with open arms?
Was not the case at
well, me, but not Don.
Yeah. No, actually, originally, it was like the revenuers were back in town. We were the outsiders. We were from out, you know, back east, and there was a level of distrust, but since then, it's not that we get a ticker tape parade each time we arrive in town. We remain very low-key and behind the scenes, but I think the museum speaks for our efforts and the fact that it also provides us with a lot of new leads, new witnesses.
We'll be back with final calls in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Did you two come up to a roadblock or anything frustrating with your work when you put the book together?
You mean like from outside interference?
Yeah.
No. We've had some interference over the years from a number of we've sort of know who it is, a former Air Force officer whose father was at Roswell. We believe he's in sort of the focus of a not only disinformation, but to try to hinder our investigation. But as far as putting the book together, continuing our research, I'm unaware of any roadblocks.
No, and I think that after the Project Mogul press conference took place in September of 1994.
What a fiasco that was.
It was, and the roadblock at that time was we ran into especially officers who it became quite apparent, were receiving phone calls making sure that they knew that they had the new marching orders, because previously, you know, there was no mention of Mogul. And the next thing we knew, they were all telling us, oh, it was just a Mogul balloon.
Hmm. What's the next big explosion for Roswell that will just propel this?
To find an actual physical piece of evidence. We thought, about a year ago, we thought we would have it in our hands by now, but the lead evaporated on us. But we are not finished with that lead. But I don't know what Don would say, but I think it would be having a piece of, say, memory metal, a real memory metal from the ship.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
It would, you know, address all concerns, all questions. We also need to emphasize that deathbed testimony is admissible in a court of law. That's one of the reasons that we could take Walter Hoth's statement, even as a posthumous document, and present in any court of law, as well as all the testimony of some of the people we've described tonight. And it would be accepted as physical evidence. That's one of the things that we've always you know, described how Roswell just had its day in court. We could pass muster. We could, you know, we could win this case hands down.
I'd love to see a TV show that reenacts Roswell with a court event where, you know, there's juries and witnesses and they make a decision. And then they simply say.
Interesting that you should mention that, because we have proposed that very scenario to a number of producers, and there is talk on both coasts that that might be the next route to go.
Good luck with that, because that
Thank
would be
you,
great.
George, yes.
That would be great. Next up, let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee now. Hello, Charlotte, you're up with us.
Well, hello, George.
Hi.
And also hi, Tom and Dan, Don.
Hello.
I just wanted to mention that I know a lady who I believe was an eyewitness to the Roswell incident. When she was a child, her and her brother, they were traveling through Roswell that summer during 1947 in a car, and they were looking out the window, and her brother both saw what they believed to be two craft up in the air. And the way she described it to me is that they looked like they actually hit into each other.
Wow.
While still in the air. And this lady, her name is Mary England. She's a co-writer on
I've
some other books.
I've interviewed her. Yeah,
with Doc. You have interviewed her?
We talked to her already, yes.
Yes.
And what do you two think
okay.
of her?
The date is wrong. At least as she described it to me. She remembers the date specifically, and it's not at the time of the Roswell incident.
Before or after?
Before.
Oh, really? Okay. Let's go to Martin in Olympia, Washington, on the wild card line. Hello,
yeah.
Martin.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm trying to get through this and then take the response off the air. Hey, guys, there's a story told by an eyewitness at the crash site that I would really kind of like to know if you guys have heard. And it basically goes that around the site or at the site, several of the, or a few, I don't know how many, one, two, three, whatever, of these little guys were milling around ambulatory, grieving, crying, or something, with little boxes in their hands, which soldiers, upon arrival, promptly, brutally, unfortunately, separated them from, the boxes, that is, from them, probably with rifle butts, if I remember correctly, possibly injuring or killing one or two. Anyway, I'd just like to know, get your comments on if you've heard that particular story, and basically I'd like to know, yeah, I guess if you've heard it before. I don't know. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Who wants
Thank
it?
You. Yes, we have heard the story, and actually we've heard it from the very source, and he's referring specifically to Gerald Anderson. And that would be a separate event that would be totally unrelated to Roswell. We're talking about the Plains of San Augustine, and we don't consider Anderson a reliable source in any manner, shape, or form, though Tom and I have spent a good amount of time out in that area because of the original story of the civil engineer Barney Barnett stumbling upon a craft and bodies around that same time period. We just don't think it's connected to the Roswell incident, because there would have been no way that base personnel from Roswell would have been that far to recover such an object, and the local sheriff and fire department, it would have been well beyond their jurisdiction at that time. So we continue to be open-minded about another incident. It's just that it seems to be completely removed from what happened as we investigated in 1947.
Mary Beth in Colorado Springs, Colorado, you're up with us. Hi.
Hi, guys. I'm calling because my uncle died because of Roswell.
Tell us, what happened?
He lived in Columbus, Ohio. His name was Robert Wilson. Not a well-known guy. He wasn't the military, but he was a hail fellow well-met, rather heavy drinker, early 40s with a young family, but had a lot of friends in town, and apparently a friend of his with connections at Wright-Patterson called him one night and said, come on down, you got to see, there's something really weird going down here. And he went out there, apparently saw the alien bodies, came home, was not a religious church-going guy at all, drinking was more important, found the family Bible, picked it up, sat speechless for 3 days, and had a stroke and died. I think I called tonight because I had not heard you guys talk about the emotional impact on some of the people who have viewed some of these things in the past, but apparently it so blew his paradigm about his place in the universe and God and so forth that his brain just couldn't absorb it all. So I just thought that might be just an interesting anecdote to some of the other things you've been talking about earlier.
Are any of his family still alive?
He may have a son, but his son would have only have been 1 or 2 years old.
Yes.
At the time, and everyone else is dead except a few nieces. I'm 64.
So how did you originally learn of the story?
It was just through my family. It's just been a family story that's been around because apparently it came through his wife and to his sister, who was my mother.
So it has been passed down through the family.
Yeah, it's nothing that would ever be documented, but it's been around with us for 60 years. So I just thought it'd be interesting because of the emotional implications.
Perhaps your producer, George, could get her name and contact number.
We'll put you on hold, Mary Beth, okay?
Okay.
And Tom, get the number and email it. He's all set. He's on top of that right now.
Great.
Let's
go
to Worcester, Massachusetts, east of the Rockies. Hello, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a question for your guest tonight.
Sure.
And I find it really interesting, but there was a press photo of the general holding the balloon, supposed balloon wreckage.
Mm-hmm. The balloon press
when they tried to do the cover-up.
Yeah.
And I guess there was a TV show where they tried to decipher what was he was holding on the telegraph.
Yeah, they tried to zoom in on it, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yes.
Has anyone figured out exactly or possibly what might be on that piece?
Well, not exactly, but we have a pretty good idea. The he's talking about the Ramey memo is what they call it. A telex that General Ramey was holding on at the time of the press conference on July 8, 1947. With modern computers and software, we are able to decipher part of that memo. It talks about the first time I saw it, the words that jumped right out at me within 10 seconds were victims, the victims of the wreck that you forwarded to the blank blank at Fort Worth, Texas. Now, right there, what weather balloon apparatus has victims? And even if you were on the ground and one hit you on the head, you would not be a victim. So,
exactly. That to me is the smoking gun.
We can make that out. It also talks about the word disc is identifiable. It also talks about setting up weather balloon demonstrations to kill the not only the Roswell story, but UFOs in general, UFO reports. And we know for a fact that in the ensuing days from that press conference, they did set up weather balloon launch demonstrations, which were carried in all the newspapers and throughout the land, and it the Roswell story was killed for 30 years, and as I understand it, the UFOs, which were a hot topic then, also died for a while.
Why the change of the story from we had a captured craft to denial? What happened?
Well, first of all, one has to always keep in mind that the military took possession of the first wreckage that the rancher Mac Brazel brought in on Sunday, July 6th. And as General DeBose, Thomas DeBose, who was Ramey's chief of staff, who we mentioned earlier, described to us that he received a phone call directly from General Clements McMullen to have that very material flown directly to Washington. So Washington is also privy to the material. The press release does not go out until about noon Central Standard Time, 2 days later on Tuesday, July 8th. So much for this being a knee-jerk response on the part of Colonel Blanchard or Walter Hopp or Major Marcel. It was all pre-staged. It was all pre-calculated because they had a much more sensitive site just north of town with the bodies. And the civilians already were talking about the debris field. They already had talked to the press. So it was a standard military operation at that time. You can't deny that something happened. So it's the creation of a straw man. First you admit it, and then you tear it down. First you acknowledge that you've recovered a flying saucer, so to speak, and then it slowly evolves into the weather balloon. And again, the press accepted that. And then they followed up, as Tom just described, with all the weather balloon demonstrations throughout the country to reinforce that position. So again, they had plenty of time to decide how to handle this. And for 30 years, they succeeded.
Great story. Los Angeles we go. Hello, Jerry. Take it away.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Well, where was the media or the public to witness these UFOs, not only back then, but since then? And why don't they stay landed long enough to meet the public or the media?
Always a good question. Who wants it?
Why don't they hang around long enough?
Yeah, why don't they be seen, these objects?
Well, you're anthropomorphizing. You're interjecting human thought and logic into what might not be their logic system. The answer is we don't know. We don't know. Why do they always seem to land out in Farmer Griswold's pumpkin patch? We just don't know.
They don't seem to want publicity.
Or they're afraid of either the manner by which we react. We mentioned earlier that the first thing we would probably do is shoot. And secondly, maybe they're smarter than we give them credit for, and that we're not ready. We're not able to handle that ultimate confrontation.
Let's go to Peekskill, New York. Dan, it's your turn.
Good evening, or good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, I just like to speak on to defend Colonel Philip Corso. I like him. And I'd also like Stanton Friedman. But the thing is that Corso wrote the book because he knew that those arrogant Air Force was going to mention that mannequin story, that bogus mannequin story. And I think he was frustrated. He had two heart attacks. He said, well, I better do something before I croak. And he did. He passed on about a year later. And also, the Disclosure Project people with Dr. Greer does indeed defend Corso, and Don Phillips is one of them. And I think what you should do is have Philip Corso Jr.'s son come back on.
Yeah, we've been working on getting him back.
Get Philip Corso Jr. on. Whatever disagreements you have about Corso, please settle your differences.
No, and we would appreciate Philip Jr. once again presenting further evidence to substantiate his father's claims. He had made a lot of promises even to us in the past, and it's now 10 years later.
They're overdue, aren't they?
He's yet to provide any corroboration. So by all means, and especially if you can arrange it, George.
Okay, we'll work on that. On the other hand, Jesse Marcel Jr. has been just the champion in all this, hasn't he?
Especially in defending his father. And his father has been viciously attacked by the bunkers in recent years. And we need to always remind people that he was the number one intelligence officer in our military at that time. The 509th Atomic Bomb Group, you know, this was a...
That was it. It was the creme de la creme.
The creme de la creme. They were assigned to be in charge of the atomic bomb. I mean, it was a composite unit composed of the best pilots, the best officers, the best crewmen, doctors, nurses, what have you. And Jess Sr. was the head of intelligence. So to suggest that, as one skeptic used to put it, well, he was a UFO buff. How could one possibly be a UFO buff back in 1947? And that he would have even put out the press release unauthorized.
God, that was an amazing time, wasn't it?
It certainly was. And
we had Kenneth Arnold sightings. We had this.
And for the Air Force to have so quickly tried to come up to speed with not only the Oversight Committee, whether one would like to believe it was MJ-12 or the Unholy 13, but the fact that they initiated Project Sign. So clearly, and any of your listeners, we often mention, can go to any public library and pull out all the newspaper microfilm from the last week of June and the first week of July, and just the banner headlines day after day after day about the arrival of the flying saucers.
Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, witness to Roswell. Thanks so much for being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.